is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week. Hello everybody, this is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne Counties. And we are here at the UCCE office in downtown Sonora. I'm talking to Linda Reevely, one of our Master Gardeners, past president of the Master Gardeners, cohort in this endeavor of the radio project. But Linda, you've got a fascinating topic today, and what is it?
My topic today is plants that are named after real people.
Okay.
And there are so many of these that are named by people either to honor someone else or just because they were their friends or for many reasons. This whole thing got started way back in the day when they began to try to scientifically classify names of all plants and animal species and even rocks and things like that. It's called the Linnaean system of classification. I'm sure if you remember your high school biology family class order, or phylum class order, family, genus,
it's
species.
It's fuzzy, but I'm kind of remembering it.
Okay. Yeah. That's the Linnaean system of organization. And what happened is that people were at that point, sort of in the 1600s, late 1500s, early 16, up through the 1800s, exploring large parts of the world that had hitherto not been explored by essentially Europeans who were trying to do all this naming business.
Right.
And so they began naming plants they found after people they knew or respected, or I guess if it was a particularly awful plant, and smelly and all that after someone they didn't like. Just don't know.
What a way to get back at someone.
No kidding. That big stinky thing over there is named after you.
Yeah. Congratulations.
No. So people have named, so we've been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
Most commonly now when people give names of famous people or entertainers or politicians, they normally are naming roses and dahlias, which in fact dahlias are named for a specific person.
Okay.
They name those things after specific people. But did you know that there's a beautiful rose called Freddie Mercury?
No, I didn't.
There is. It's a beautiful red rose.
Aww.
And it was named by fans of Freddie Mercury who really wanted to honor him in this way after he passed away.
Oh, that's lovely.
So there is a Freddie Mercury rose.
Wow.
Which is pretty fun, I think.
I think that's a lot of fun. That really is.
There is a lady in Chicago whose name is Linda Lee Stuckey. And Linda Lee has built her entire garden around plants named after Star Trek.
Oh, no. Really?
Mm-hmm. There's the Captain Kirk and Enterprise hostias.
What kind of plants are these?
These are hostas. The Captain
They're
Kirk
hostas.
And the,
uh-huh. Okay.
She has lilies called Spock's ears.
Oh,
and
my
Borg
gosh.
Technology, Neutral Zone, and Romulan Defector.
Oh, that sounds just very powerful.
Isn't that just great?
It is.
Lilies. These names, anything that's named after a person, is called an eponym.
Okay.
Name. It means name for someone or something,
okay.
Basically. And some of them are just funny. And some of them are kind of nice.
So, Linda, that brings it up. What if I want to have a name on a plant? How do I go about that?
Well, if you wanted to know, for instance, if there was a plant named for you, Debbie, you could look up plants named Debbie on the internet, and you would come up with what I found today, which is there's an absolutely lovely succulent named Debbie, and there's the almost perfect pink rhododendron called Debbie.
Aww, that's
it's
so
just
sweet.
Beautiful.
But what if I want a plant that's unique to
you?
Me, just like how the like a Freddie Mercury rose?
Well, what you would have to do is find a new sport or variety of a plant And then you decide what you want to call it. And of course, you need a whole scientific name.
Uh-huh.
And that can include your name. There's nothing that says you can't. And then if that was, for instance, a fern, I would go to the Fern Societies online and see how they handle the naming of new plants.
Okay.
Usually there's a process to determine if that is a unique cultivar.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it is, voila, you are part of the history of natural history. They'll name it after you.
Oh my gosh, wouldn't that be fun?
Is that fun? I think it's kind of cool.
That is fun.
There is a Sir Paul McCartney rose.
Oh, lovely.
Robert Frost Hosta.
Oh,
after
my
the
gosh.
Road Less Traveled.
Oh,
a Michelle
clever.
Obama orchid.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. A Cher bearded iris.
Oh my gosh, and I love bearded iris.
They're clematis named for both Princess Diana and Prince Charles.
Aww, that's so sweet. That's very sweet.
There are roses called Romeo and Juliet.
Juliet. That's cute.
Isn't that great? I
that
love it.
That is great.
There's a rose called Elvis Lives.
Oh.
I don't know what it looks like, but there is a rose called Elvis Lives.
Oh my gosh.
There is the Elizabeth Taylor rose, which is a spectacular rose. It's pale pink with the tips of the petals are darker.
Oh,
and it smells really nice. It's a tea rose. It's lovely.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Yep, Elizabeth Taylor is a beauty. Cherokee, beautiful red rose.
Okay.
But there's also Sitting Bull.
Oh.
I don't know what that one looks like, but
oh my gosh,
there's
but a rose. That's a rose.
Yep.
Who knew?
There's Abraham Lincoln.
Okay.
And Mr. Lincoln.
So there's two different roses.
Named for Abraham Lincoln. Yep.
Wow.
There's the John F. Kennedy rose, which mm-hmm. is one of the most perfect white tea roses ever bred. They are just stunning.
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful, large rose. Uh-huh. It holds its petals very well. They
good,
do well
good
here.
Good for cuttings.
They're for cutting. And they're just a stunning white rose. If you're a white rose fan, that one's a really good one. So this didn't just get started, though, in modern times. This has been going on quite a while, as I mentioned before. And we end up with a lot of interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see a good deal of it here, but we should. And because forsythia, that plant that blooms with the yellow blossoms in the spring,
right,
that isn't Scotch broom,
right,
which is, in fact, invasive here.
Right, but forsythia is one of those plants that they suggest that if you like Scotch broom, and that would be a perfect...
It's a great choice.
Choice for the garden.
Yeah, and forsythia is named for William Forsyth, who was a prominent British horticulturist, and he lived from 1734 to 1804. So this is a while back there.
Oh, yeah.
But
is going
he
a while
became
back.
The royal gardener for both Kensington and St. James Palaces.
I'll be darned.
Which are both beautifully landscaped to this day.
Oh,
and
wow.
owe quite a bit to good old Forsythia and the lovely plants named after him.
Isn't that fun? I've been saying that name for years, and I had no idea that it was actually named after a wonderful gardener.
The wonderful gardener. A very famous one is Forsythia suspensa fortunii. And that's, it has very large yellow blossoms, and some of them kind of hang down a little bit.
Oh,
and
lovely.
That's the suspensa part.
Uh-huh.
But Fortunii is Robert Fortune. Is that a great name for somebody who was kind of an adventurer, which this fellow was? He was a traveler and horticulturist in China. He traveled all over China looking for rare and unusual plants.
Oh, really?
Yep. It was Robert Fortune who brought the tea culture from China to India.
Oh my gosh.
And part of why this happened is that the Chinese had a very closed culture and a very tightly controlled port situation. And they wanted to trade tea out of their country, specifically, entirely, almost to be sent to India. Mm-hmm. Or not the tea, the tea went to Europe, but they also wanted to send opium to India.
Oh.
And a lot of these people thought that it was very expensive for them to be doing that. And the second thing is they thought we could probably grow tea in India, which they did and they still do.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Fortune is the fellow who took the tea to India and got it going.
Oh my gosh, isn't that something?
Yeah.
That is so much fun.
The Magnolia Sulangiana was named for Peter Mangold, born in 1638 and died in 1715. He was a professor of medicine, but also the director of the Botanic Garden at Montpellier, and also named after Etienne Soulange-Boudin, the Soulangiana, who was a French horticulturalist. And both of their names are memorialized in the beautiful Magnolia Sulangiana.
Oh, how lovely. How lovely.
Isn't that wonderful?
That is wonderful.
I think it's pretty cool.
I love that.
There's a crab apple, a flowering tree,
okay,
called the Parkman crab quite frequently, but its scientific name is, in fact, Malus Holliana Parkmanii. And it's named after George Hall, who lived in Bristol, Rhode Island. This guy's an American.
Okay.
Graduated from the Harvard Medical School in 1846 and went off to China, and in 1855 actually went to Japan.
Wow.
From Japan, in about 1863, he sent back to our country, or he was sent to this country by F. Gordon Dexter of Boston, a plant that was a Japanese crab apple that he found in the home garden of Francis Parkman in Jamaica Plain. It's probably true that the double-flowered Japanese apple was thus introduced to America before it made it to Europe, and it was named for the two men who brought it into cultivation.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't
that is so exciting.
Yeah.
It really is. It's just so much fun.
Mahonia. Remember our Holly Mahonia?
Sure.
The Gorgon grape?
Right.
Named for Bernard Mahan.
Mahan. Okay.
Yeah, it was really Mac Mahan.
Okay.
But somehow he lost the AC and there's just an apostrophe in his name.
Okay. And what did he do?
And Mahan was a prominent American horticulturist.
Oh.
And Mahonia was named by Thomas Nuttall, who was an American who just named practically everything.
Right?
Thomas Nuttall, he was something else. Really impressive. Let's see if I can find another one here. How about Wisteria?
Wisteria.
Which is sometimes spelled, which always used to drive me completely nuts, Wisteria.
Uh-huh.
Which is, it's perfectly okay, actually, because it's named after, by good old Thomas Nuttall,
okay,
Caspar Wistar.
Oh.
Born in 1761, died in 1818. Dr. Wistar was a professor of anatomy at the University of Pennsylvania. And the Wisteria, there are Native American Wisterias.
Okay.
But they aren't nearly as spectacular as the Chinese and Japanese varieties that we grow.
Right.
The kind that have the long pendulous blossoms.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And
so that's actually Japanese or Chinese varieties.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are the ones that you never want to plant on your house because they are so powerful that they will essentially destroy your house.
Yes. So strong. Yes.
Oh, yes. They are an amazing thing.
But that's great advice.
Be very careful with them.
Plant them somewhere where they're not going to destroy anything.
Yep. Wigella.
Oh, yeah.
Lovely Wigella, also spelled Wigellia, is a shrub that has these clusters of pink flowers.
Right.
Remember,
it's
you've seen it in the springtime.
Oh,
it's lovely.
It's very
pretty.
It's named
for Christian Einfried von Wegel, a German physician and naturalist, who wrote a book called Observations Botanicae and some other works. And
what a great way to memorialize people that have passed on by actually making their name live forever
as the scientific name of some plant.
Now, how about you actually had have a list as far as plant names that people are naming their babies a lot of times that are popular, and it's so sweet.
This is a new list that's just out in one of the wonderful baby naming sites, and it has these names that they're suggesting for babies. Some nice A names for girls include acacia, alder, almond.
Okay.
I guess if you live down in the valley and you're not harvesting them yet, amen.
Yeah, that's true.
Aloe, amaranth, amaryllis.
Anemone, I like that too.
It's not pronounced anemone, guys. It's anemone.
Anemone, which is lovely.
Aspen, aster, and azalea.
Ooh, those are all lovely.
Some of them are a little out there. This is, I think you'd have to be particularly, as we say in my family, crunchy granola to go for some of these, but here you go.
Crunchy granola.
There's bay, beech, begonia, and belladonna. Now, I would never name a baby belladonna because belladonna is a toxic poison.
Yes.
Whose name means beautiful lady. Just name the baby Bella or Donna.
Right.
Don't put them both together into a toxic poison.
Yeah, that's
just not very nice.
That isn't nice.
But you know why belladonna is called that, don't you?
No.
Belladonna was used as a liquid that you dropped in your eyes.
Uh-huh.
It dilates your eyes.
Oh.
And when our eyes are dilated and we look at someone else, first of all, they're fuzzy, which is actually probably a good thing if you're looking for a new husband. But second of all, dilated eyes indicate interest.
Oh, yes.
Our eyes dilate when we're interested
in
something.
Right.
So gentlemen used to think that these women whose eyes were completely wide open, black practically, so fascinated with them.
Oh, how interesting.
And I'm sure these women couldn't see these men very well, so
maybe
they were more interesting.
Yeah, could be.
Isn't that great?
That is great.
I think, there's two lovely names here. One is Bluebell.
Okay.
Which was my daughter's play name when she was little.
Aww,
she insisted
that's sweet.
On being called Bluebell for a long time. And then there's Buttercup.
Aww.
I think that's really sweet,
that
too.
That is sweet, too.
There's all kinds
of... How about men, though?
Boys' names. Alder.
Okay.
The list suggests alfalfa, but I'm not going to go there. I think that's kind of strange.
That is strange.
But ash and aspen are really good.
Yeah.
Basil.
Oh, I've known a basil.
Beech and birch.
Okay.
Cedar. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Elm.
Okay.
Garland. I've known several men named Garland, and they've always been very nice.
Isn't that more of an old-fashioned name?
It is.
Okay.
It is.
I mean, it isn't a recent.
I come from Utah where people are still named Garland, but
okay.
I think it's a great and lovely name.
It's a great name.
Juniper.
Oh.
And then you could always name your child Kale.
Kale.
Now, I've seen kids named Kale, and I always think, why are you naming your kid after, kind of like spinach thing? But to each his own, and it is a nice sounding name.
It is a very nice sounding name.
There's also Linden and Mace.
I've known people named Linden.
I have
too. I've never known anybody named Mace.
I've known a couple people named Mace. Again,
have you?
It's a real old-fashioned name. But I think it's a good one.
Yeah.
Number 27 on my list here is Narcissus. Now, a Narcissus is a kind of daffodil.
Right.
But Narcissus is also the character in mythology who was set himself off in the woods to look at his own reflection in the water every day. And a beautiful wood nymph came and tried to get him interested in her, and all he would do was stare at himself in the water. And he would have nothing to do with her.
Oh,
hence
goodness.
Our phrase, narcissist.
Oh, so that's where it came from.
That
wouldn't be nice.
Well, in my family, we do have a Narcisse.
A Narcisse? Oh.
Mm-hmm. He was one of a set of twins born to my great-grandmother.
Uh-huh.
My grandmother's generation. There was Joseph and Narcisse.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is a really interesting name for somebody born in Montana.
Yes, that is. That is very interesting.
But Dad was French-Canadian, so there
okay.
you are. I don't think I'd name my child Oleander, but it's not a bad name in some ways.
No.
A pine and reed and Rowan are wonderful names.
Rowan, that sounds very
Isn't
nice.
Isn't Rowan good?
I like that.
I like sage for both boys and girls.
Yes, I
think that's a really
that's
nice
very
name.
Nice.
They suggest Sequoia.
Uh-huh.
I would suggest that since we live so close to them, that might not be a great choice for here.
Right.
But there you go. They also suggest Wattle, which I think is completely dreadful.
Oh, that seems at the
Why
very...
Why would you name your kid Wattle?
I don't know.
No. Don't do that out there in Radio Land. That's just crazy.
Stay away from it.
Stay away from that one. But the last one they suggest for boys, and I really like this one, is Yarrow.
Yes, that is.
Isn't that a beautiful name?
It is.
It flows off the tongue.
Yes.
It seems like a really neat
mm-hmm.
name.
It does. And Linda, it's always fascinating having you and talking about different subjects. So this has been a great subject to talk about. We'll talk again, and thank you so much.
You're welcome. See you soon.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Debbie Powell. coordinator, the Master Gardener coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne counties, and I am Sonora Day, and I've got the great opportunity to talk to Becky Miller Cripps, who is a Tuolumne Master Gardener and also a former Master Gardener coordinator, has worked on many grants. I would continue with her bio, but I've got some pressing questions that I wanted to ask her, and one of them is related to the fact that the Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County for many years have written articles about leaves, falling leaves in the yard. And I'm going to ask Becky, are the leaves in our yard, what do we do with them? I mean, are they bad, good? What's, I mean, there's, we just, some of us just get so many leaves. What can we do?
Well, leaves are a great source of organic matter that can be added right back into your soil. And so leaves are a bonus, and they can be used to create an additive or an amendment for your soil, and you don't have to go out and spend money for bagged amendments that you might buy at the home improvement store. So we like to recommend that you leave the leaves, and I know many people who still have lawns are unhappy about the effect of leaves on their lawns because a heavy blanket of leaves can smother the growth of your grass. But there is a saying in the world of native oak management that the oak tree knows what the oak tree needs, and so the leaves that drop are best left under the tree to create a natural sort of fertilizing amendment that will add organic matter to your soil. Now, there are lots of different ways that you can actually utilize the leaves. If you don't want to leave them on the ground to create that natural amendment, you can rake them up and pile them in a corner of your backyard that's unobtrusive. And within about a year, you will have lovely, it's called leaf mold, and it's not a mold, it's the English word spelled M-O-U-L-D. And what it is a partially decomposed organic matter. So basically, compost happens no matter what. And if you leave the leaves in a pile in your backyard, within about 1 year, you'll have a lovely compost, or known as leaf mold.
It does sound wonderful. And could you add that leaf mold to anything? Or is there a specific plants, maybe? I mean, could you add it to your vegetable garden? Would that be a good use of the leaf mold?
Well, if you happen to use pesticides in your gardening practices, we would recommend that any leaves that may have encountered drift from pesticide spray, or maybe even a little spray of some weeds on your property with glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, we would not recommend that you would put that leaf litter or that leaf mold into your vegetable garden. But it could definitely be put on the ground under landscape shrubs, for example, or something like that.
Well, that's a good idea.
And then if you didn't want to just stack your leaves in a corner and let them decompose for a year, you can actually chop them up either by running a lawnmower over them, or you can put them into a big garbage can and use your line trimmer to whack them up, or you can run them through a chipper shredder and add them to your compost pile, or use them as a basis to create a new compost pile. The leaves that are falling now would be considered a brown, high carbon content material, and so you could layer that with, say, kitchen scraps or grass trimmings or things like that to create a really nice compost pile.
And those would be considered green? So you're talking about your kitchen scraps and maybe some of the grass clippings, things like that. And then I know sometimes people think that composting is this really super complicated thing. And I think a lot of times, because they think it's complicated, they simply don't want to do it. And the other thing that I've heard is compost piles can smell. And so that's why they don't want to do that. But what's your thoughts on that?
It's true that compost piles can smell, and it's true that if you try to do really rigorous composting, it can be a complicated process, because if you pay close attention and turn the pile every day, you can get compost in as little as 2 weeks, 14 days. And most people don't want to put in the energy that's required to make that happen. Now, me, I'm a very lazy composter, and so what I do is take all the leaves that are available to me in the fall, pile them into a 3x3x3 bin. That's the minimum size that you want as far as heat generation.
Okay.
And then you can mix in your green nitrogen-containing materials such as kitchen scraps or, as we said, grass clippings, things like that, weeds without seeds and runners. And all of those can be layered in, and then you can just let it sit. And within a few months, you will have some lovely compost.
You know, that sounds wonderful, and I love the thought that this is free. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is
you
just
bet.
Stuff. I mean, this,
yes.
You know, I'm all about free.
I'm into frugal.
I am too. But you mentioned something to not add into your compost pile, and you called it runners. So are you talking about, by any chance, Bermuda grass, like that type of runner, or what are you maybe referring to?
Well, plants that spread by some kind of either underground or overground propagative structure, and they can be referred to as stolons or as runners or other words like that. And I won't go into the botanical definitions of those right now. But things that tend to spread in that way can be a problem in compost piles. Now, amazingly, and I know this from practical experience because I moved into a house that was built in the very late 60s, very early 70s, when Bermuda grass lawns were the standard. And so I have Bermuda grass creeping in everywhere. But the thing that's amazing is if you pull it or cut it, that material doesn't seem to be propagative. And so those runners, I tend not to put them in my compost pile. But once they're pulled, they seem to die on the spot. They seem to not be propagative and causing problems in your compost. But there are definite things like field bindweed, which is the little wild morning glory, that definitely can propagate in your compost pile. So anything that looks like it's sort of crawling across your landscape, you would not want to put that in your compost.
That's good advice. Otherwise, you're going to be dealing with it in the future.
Oh,
it's
yes,
not
you'll be
go
spreading
away.
It everywhere.
Oh, no.
Exactly.
A gardening nightmare.
Right.
Now, when you had talked about the size of the compost pile being the 3x3x3, and that is to, one of the reasons is to generate enough heat. What kind of heat, are you saying that the compost pile itself will generate the heat, or are you adding some extra heat, or what's going on with the heat?
There are two different ways that you can compost. There's cold composting and there's warm composting. Cold composting is literally piling the material in a corner of the backyard and leaving it alone for a year. And that just breaks down naturally. What happens when you pile things together or layer them together with green nitrogen containing materials and brown carbon containing materials is that the microorganisms and the macroorganisms start to feed on the materials in the compost, and their biological processes along with the breakdown of the plant materials does create heat.
Okay.
And so when you have a pile that's a minimum of 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, you will get enough warmth in the center of the pile to kill many of the organisms that we don't want in our compost pile. And so that heat helps with the degeneration or the decomposition of the materials. It also helps in killing weed seeds, killing certain maybe disease organisms or things like that. And so that heat is very helpful in creating compost.
Okay. Well, gosh, Becky, oh, one more thing?
I wanted to add one more thing because people often know that adding some kind of manure to your compost pile, like turkey manure,
oh, right.
Chicken manure,
right.
Things like that can add heat to your
right.
compost. But if that is the case, you do want to be careful and allow the compost to go through its entire process because you don't want the temperature to in the center of the pile to go above 160 degrees. because that will kill off the beneficial organisms that are helping with the decomposition, and you'll basically have to start over in your process.
Oh gosh, we don't want that.
Right.
We want it to be fairly easy. Well, Becky, thank you so much. I think that's all the time we have for today, but can we have you come back again?
Oh, of course. And don't forget, leave your leaves.
That's right. Thank you so much. Goodbye.